Today is Monday, September 26, 2011. I'm Nina Kurgia.
I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And this is News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake. There's nothing more for any.
Good evening. It's 5:10, and this is time for a full hour of independent news. Today, we will be interviewing Don Davis about Dick Cheney's controversial visit to Canada, as well as an interview with a BCCLA spokesperson about the Hassan Diab case, as well as an interview with Richard Vial of Clearbrook Entertainment.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent, local, national, and international news.
But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Bolivia's Minister of Defense resigned today after police violently broke up an indigenous protest camp. Sean Arquinego and Aldo Orellana report from Cochabamba.
Cecilia Chacon called the police action unjustifiable. Last night, hundreds of Bolivian police fired tear gas and used batons to break up a peaceful protest march headed for La Paz. A six-month-old baby died after inhaling tear gas. Dozens were injured, and more than 30 others are unaccounted for. The march was led by native Bolivians who are opposed to a highway construction project that would cut through their territory. Some 1,500 people were camped outside the town of Yucumo. Government officials claim that they entered the camp in an attempt to diffuse tensions between marchers and the residents of the town who support the highway construction project. Rolando Villena, head of the Bolivian Ombudsman Office, demanded a halt to violence and threatened to pursue legal action against the government. Vigils and protests are now being carried out in major cities around Bolivia against the actions of the government. Sean Arquinego, FSRN, Cochabamba.
The Mexican state of Veracruz has become a major hotspot in the so-called war against drugs. Until now, the major actors have been members of organized crime or federal forces. But Shannon Young explains that may be changing.
Several aspects of the violence in Veracruz make it stand out from the bloodshed in other parts of Mexico, notably the emergence of an armed group bearing the appearance of a paramilitary organization. A group calling itself Los Matacetas, the Zeta Killers, has uploaded a couple of video communiques to the internet, the most recent one dated Saturday, September 24th. The video shows five men in ski masks wearing all black and seated at a table laid out in conference-style formality.
Nuestro único interés como objetivo son el cártel de los Zetas.
The speaker expressed respect for the armed forces and said the goal of the Matacetas is to fight the Zetas cartel in a way the military cannot due to legal restrictions. It was the first communique from the group since at least 35 bodies were dumped near an overpass in Boca del Río, Veracruz last week. A state government official claimed the dead were criminals before medical examiners had established the identities of all of the murder victims. The mother of a 15-year-old boy found among the dead said the last time she saw her son, he was in state police custody. Three reporters covering this story for major national media outlets were briefly detained on Thursday while documenting the condition of the bodies in the morgue and forced by armed Veracruz State Police to delete photos. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
For the first time since the 2010 Gulf oil disaster, BP has applied for permits to start drilling again off the Louisiana coast. The company wants to drill four new wells almost 6,000 feet down. A BP spokesperson says the company has learned its lesson and now has enhanced performance standards. Cynthia Sartho is with the Gulf Restoration Network.
Our concern is whether they have in fact, you know, implemented the safety standards they say, and if not, whether they are actually any more capable than they were before at responding to a situation in which something goes wrong.
Federal regulators have until late next month to rule on BP's request. Kenya's Professor Wangari Maathai, the Nobel Peace Laureate of 2004, died last night. She was 71. John Bwakali has more from Nairobi.
Wangari Maathai was the first woman to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Decades earlier, she was also the first woman to be awarded a doctorate in all of East and Central Africa. Maathai founded the Green Belt Movement in 1977. Through it, she mobilized women across Kenya to empower themselves and conserve the environment by planting trees. This movement has since planted more than 47 million trees. In the 1980s, she was the environmental conscience of Kenya, taking on the government in defending natural spaces and resources both in urban and rural areas. Her courageous activism often landed her in prison, but she refused to be silenced. In 2002, she won a parliamentary seat and became the nation's Assistant Minister of Environment. After winning the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004, she steered the United Nations Environment Programme's Billion Tree campaign, greatly enhancing environmental awareness all over the world. Wangari Maathai died from ovarian cancer. She is survived by three adult children. John Bwakali, FSRN, Nairobi.
And on Friday, a California jury awarded $4.5 million to the family of a homeless man who died while in police custody. Jurors found that two Eureka police officers used excessive force against Martin Cotton, and three others failed to provide him with medical care. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at FSRN.org. I'm Nina Kurigia.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And here are your news headlines. Suzanne Anton promised she is committed in making streetcar permanent fixtures in Vancouver if she gets the mayoral seat in November's civic election. The master plan is to reestablish the downtown streetcar network that would connect Granville Island, Olympic Village, and Science World to Chinatown and Waterfront Station. The city has already invested $8.5 million for a streetcar demonstration project, which ran during the 2010 Winter Games. Anton said the project would need to update the 2005 cost numbers, which is around $120 million.
Premier Clark announces new measures for her jobs plan. Premier Christy Clark continued to release details about the upcoming provincial jobs plan this week, with the announcement of efforts to improve job creation at new business, improve training, and reduce red tape in BC. Her speech announced a $3 million increase to a tax credit offered to venture capitalists funding the creation of new business. Program's total value is now $33 million annually. Clark also informed the three-year extension of a program offering tax credits to apprentices and their employers. She said that the majority of new jobs in the economy are created by new businesses, and the plan can do it by increasing access to venture capital. The opposition NDP leader Adrian Dix criticized the announcement as little more than an expensive repackaging initiative.
The Vancouver Art Gallery is celebrating its 80th anniversary with an autobiographical exhibition spanning all of its historical and collected art. An autobiography of Out Collection, which runs Saturday until February 12th next year, features more than 80 artists chosen among more than 10,000 works in the gallery's holdings. The selected pieces will explore the institution's history, journey, and identity. Visitors will get to see Thomas Cooper Canterbury's Meadows and a few of Emily Carr's works and Andy Warhol's Mao Zedong. Patrons will also have a chance to see videos of the behind-the-scenes work of gallery staff. Vancouver Art Gallery is also featuring The Color of My Dreams, The Surrealist Revolution in Art, off-site Elspeth Pratt and Ken Lum exhibitions.
A new Statistics Canada report found Canadians consume 26 teaspoons of sugar a day, which works out to 21% of their daily calorie intake. The U.S. Institute of Medicine says no more than 25% of total energy intake should come from added sugars. The World Health Organization recommends a daily maximum of 10% of calories from free sugars. However, the study shows that 35% of it came from foods like soft drinks and candies, while 31% came from vegetables and fruits. The report also says that the sugar consumption is lowest among women 71 and older, and highest among teenage boys.
We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Are you looking for career information relevant to your arts degree? Come check out Work Your BA, a career workshop series specifically designed for art students. Find out what you can do with your major, learn how to improve your resume, discover the secrets to networking, and much, much more. For more information, visit www.arts.ubc.ca/students/workyourba.
Walking alone at night can be scary!
Stop right there, student. Why walk alone when you can call Safe Walk? The safety and comfort of everyone on campus is important. That's why we're here.
Safe Walk is a free, student-run foot patrol service with two-person co-ed teams that will meet you and accompany you anywhere on campus to make sure you get there safely.
Keep an eye out for our bright red reflective jackets and signature foot logo, and let your next walk be with us.
What a huge relief! Now I'll never have to worry about the terrors that could happen when walking through such a big campus at night.
For a walk, you can call 604-822-5355. Use one of our direct line phones located in some of the campus libraries. Use one of the big blue phone booths, or even ask campus security to contact us.
If you see walkers around campus, and you'd like them to accompany you, stop and ask.
And now our weekly weather forecast with Greg Allen from the UBC Storm Club.
It is currently 13 degrees at UBC and overcast, with the 16-kilometer-hour winds from the southeast. There is a strong low-pressure system off the coast of BC, and the associated front produced high winds and heavy rain for the region, which have eased with the passage of the front. As the system weakens, showers are expected with a break in the weather by midweek, a possibility of rain later in the week, and sun for the weekend. Here is your weekday forecast for UBC. Monday evening into overnight will be cloudy with a low of 12 degrees. Tuesday will be cloudy with showers developing in the morning and a high of 14 degrees. Tuesday night will be cloudy with a low of 12 degrees. For Wednesday, we will see clearing in the morning and a mix of sun and cloud with a low of 8 and a high of 16 degrees. Thursday will be cloudy with a chance of showers, a low of 9 and a high of 17 degrees. Friday will be cloudy with a chance of showers, a low of 10 and a high of 14 degrees. Saturday will be sunny with a low of 8 and a high of 17. And Sunday will be partly cloudy, a low of 8 and a high of 17. The normal temperatures for this time of year are a maximum of 17 degrees and a minimum of 9. That's your weather this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Greg Allen.
Thank you, Greg Allen, from the UBC Storm Club. Next, we have a story produced by Iqbal Ahmed, who interviewed Richard Wheel of Clearbrook Entertainment.
And I'm joined in the studio right now with Richard Wheeld. And Richard is from Clearbrook Entertainment. So first of all, Richard, what is Clearbrook Entertainment?
Cool. Hey, Iqbal, first of all, thanks for having me on your show today.
Of course.
But yeah, Clearbrook Entertainment is a production company that I started with a few of my friends and coworkers. And basically, first of all, what a production company does is it brings together all of the things needed to make a movie or a TV show or I guess even anything else. But we are focused on movies and making those. So what we do is like try and secure financing and find distribution and find actors and directors and every other small role, even like set security and like those people that make sandwiches. We are responsible for bringing all of those things together in hopes of getting a movie made. And most importantly, I think most importantly, we have to also find scripts to make movies about. And my company, Clearbrook Entertainment, we have actually written a script ourselves, and that's sort of how the company was formed. We have a movie, and then we decided that we don't want to sell that to other people and have them make it, but we want to stay the course and take it from like nothing to everything. So, yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm. So your company was started as a way to produce your own project.
Yeah.
And so in the future, do you think it will take on more projects that aren't directly linked to yourself?
Yeah, for sure. That's actually like a real hope of ours, actually. Like we're making our first movie right now and things are going well, but ultimately we would like to make a really big career out of this, and like being a production company where people come to us with like their scripts, or like their agents come to us or their lawyers or whatever, and we can make their movies too. So it's a company about like elevating ourselves and like making our dreams come true, but mm-hmm. also at the end of the day, like trying to help other people and inspiring other people to do their own thing, and we want to help them do that and make their movies. So yeah, that is a dream.
Aiming high, Richard.
Aiming high, man. Shoot for the stars.
Yeah. And I've heard you recently took a trip down to LA as part of this project.
Yeah, man. We went to Los Angeles a few weeks ago. It was the second week of school, so that's really early to start skipping. But yeah, we went down to LA. We were supposed to have a meeting, my business partners and I, with who has now become the executive producer of our film, which is called Riverside. So in the beginning, I can already like tell you that this meeting was pretty fruitful, but I didn't really know what to expect. The original plan was to first like have a meeting with this woman. Her name is Alex Townsend. She is very, very nice and also helping us along a lot. She's going to be the executive producer in our film, but we met up with her and we're having lunch, and the plan was to sort of bang down doors to sort of start making a reality television thing. Like a reality television show that we want to be part of this movie project, but she also had like a contact at Universal Studios, and she was like, "Hey, like I'll get you guys to meet with him later, like no problem." And like for three guys that were just like sort of starting out making a company, not really know what's going on, like we were in no way prepared to have a meeting at Universal Studios. So we had like 5 hours in which to do this, and we're like, "Oh man, what are we gonna do?" And so we like sat down, we like pounded out like a plan and a pitch and a proposal, and in the beginning it didn't go like super well, but eventually we got comfortable, and like I got to pitch, or like the three of us got to pitch like our movie to this guy and tell him what it's all about and how we want to market it and how we want to take it. And for me, like a main role was talking about like this reality TV show that we want to use as like a vehicle to promote like our movie and as well as ourselves. And I killed it, not to like brag or anything like that, but it was like a really, really cool experience to come from like just like being at school every day and like working a job at a bar that I really don't, like I really, really don't like, to like pitching like a movie and a TV show to like an executive like in control of like buying things at like a movie studio. So it was really, really cool. And eventually, like, we didn't like knock on doors, like bang down doors at MTV, because things became like too busy talking about this. But that's kind of like a plan that we have for like a next trip to LA. But things from that trip like were really, really, really fruitful. Like not so much at the very beginning, but now Because of that trip, we have like our executive producer, Alex, and we also have a director attached to our film, and we also have a letter of intent for distribution. So now like people are signing on to what we're doing, and like it really, really looks right now that we're going to like make a movie, and it's going to be awesome. So really, really excited about that. So going to L.A., not knowing what's going on can sometimes really, really pay off.
Yeah, sounds like your pitch was very fruitful, as you said. And could you give us a bit of that pitch right now?
Man, you want me to give you a pitch?
Yeah.
Like slow ball, curve ball, change up. Ah, that's baseball. Sure, I can tell you a little bit. I would love to talk about like our pitch and our show or like anything I want. That's why I'm on the radio now. But yeah, basically the pitch for our show is that people are struggling right now and life is really hard. Like people have bills to pay, people have expenses, a lot of people are losing their jobs because of the economy, and there's not like a lot of positivity out there right now when it comes to like working and feeling good about yourself financially. And you know, like rich people are getting richer and poor people are getting poorer, and there's like a lot of uncertainty out there right now. If like the American dream is still a real thing, like can people that don't have a lot like really make something of themselves? And like we like on one hand want this show to be like inspirational and show that like just three normal guys like me, Richard, and my business partners Kane and Joel can get out there and make things happen. And it's about being passionate, it's about being charismatic and funny and relatable. It's just three guys trying to make their dreams come true, and we have that aspect of the show. And also the part that I think is more appealing to other people and not just for me, is that part of making a movie and building a company is that you get to meet like famous actors and TV personalities all the time. So like while the show is on one hand about like making your dreams come true and just like seeing people grow, it's also about having lunch with like Justin Bieber and being like, what's up Justin Bieber, how are you doing today, I really like your purple hoodie. And so it's about like your dreams coming true and also about rubbing shoulders with famous people and watching how movies get made. And like we kind of want the narrative of the show to be from like us in the beginning, like right now we don't have a lot, but we have some hopes and some dreams to eventually like at the end of like a season of a show, like us signing deals, us making a movie, like us walking down a red carpet. So it's just like a journey through like Hollywood, like just like the magic there, and also like individuals making their dreams come true. So that's kind of the pitch. It's a little bit less polished. You're a little bit less like an executive at Universal, but I'm really excited about the show. That's my main focus right now, but thank you for asking.
Yeah, no worries. And do you think the show will get made?
I hope the show will get made. It's really hard to like get through the door when you don't have like an agent and you don't have a lawyer. Maybe one day I want to be a lawyer, but right now it's really hard to like get into a studio because people want to like protect their own liability. Like say like I come to them with an idea and I don't have a lawyer, like they could steal it and it can like lead to lawsuits, and like not people like understand contracts and the things that go in there. So like getting into studios is really hard, but because of like our last trip to LA, like we have like made some contacts there now, which like have been in this business for a long time, and now they are actively like working for us on their part because like they are more like focused on the movie aspect of everything that's going on. But if the movie is successful, like the TV show is a good marketing venue for that. But right now I'm kind of like working on like a new pitch, whereas like I can't go to LA all the time because sometimes I have to be in class. You can only say like, hey, going to LA for a trip, sorry professor. Eventually they're like, why don't you just drop my class and leave me alone? But yeah, I'm working on like a video pitch for like trying to be like ingenuitive, but I really hope the show gets made. I think it's in like the best interest of like people to make the show because like it's gonna be really, really cool. I'm pretty fun. But yeah, I hope it gets made.
Yeah, sounds really interesting. And maybe tell us more about the movie you're working on.
Okay, tell you more about the movie. I don't want to tell you too much.
Yeah, too much of it.
That would spoil it. Like, you know when you go to the movie?
Tease us with it.
Tease you with it.
Yeah.
Okay, tease you with it. Well, I am going to tease you by sort of beating around the bush as I think about what to say here. But yeah, basically, it was written in the most part by my friend and partner, Joel Ross. The movie is called Riverside. And if you want to look at it, oh man, how to describe this movie when I don't usually describe it, let's ask that question again.
We'll just ask a different question.
Let's ask you a different question.
Yeah.
That'd be a super good idea.
So personally, how did you get involved with this project?
How I got involved in this project is kind of a crazy story. My friend and coworker Joel, he approached me in like the very beginning of the summer, and he's like, "Hey, I've been writing a script for a movie, and I really want to get this movie made. Do you want to be my business partner?" And initially, I was like, "I don't know anything about movies or partnerships or about anything that you're doing, and I'm also going on like a summer job where I'm going to be tour guiding children on a bus, and I won't be able to talk to you for like 3 months. Why do you want me to be a part of this company?" He's like, "Well, you're good at talking to people, and you're my friend." And I was just thinking, like, there's no way I want to be part of this terrible, terrible company. But eventually, like, the idea of, like, making, like, a reality TV show came out, and I was like, oh, that sounds really, really cool. I would love to be TV/internet famous. And so, and then I learned that another one of, like, my coworkers from the bar that I work at, Kayan, he was going to be attached to the project, and I'm always, like, really, really excited about things that he is interested in, because we enjoy the same TV show, so, like, how can you not trust that person? But it's, like, really sort of just, like, I don't want to, like, say lucky, but, like, really sort of random. I'm just, like, being friends with a person that has a dream that is, like, similar to yours. Just, like, you are willing to sort of try anything to, like, make life cooler, more exciting, more adventurous, and, like, ultimately more fruitful for yourself. And so, just, like, by knowing someone who was interested in making a movie, and I eventually, like, became passionate about that as well. Yeah. So, kind of crazy, but also super lucky.
Yeah, hopefully when you're at the top, you won't forget CITR.
I'll never forget CITR, or you, Iqbal.
Thank you, Richard.
It's always good to see you.
You too. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, just at the end, thank you everybody for listening. I don't know if there's like 10 people or like 25 million people. I don't really know how popular CITR or Iqbal Ahmed on the radio is, but if you guys would like to learn a little bit more about our project, please go to www.clearbrookentertainment.com. It's our website. It talks about our current projects, and we'll have a lot of updates with what we're doing. Also follow us on Twitter at ClearbrookEnt, so Clearbrook, E-N-T, and also follow us on Facebook, so www.facebook.com/ClearbrookEnt. One way we're trying to promote our TV show right now is having like little webisodes or like little video updates, so please like visit them, check us out, follow along as we try and make our dreams come true. Stay excited. Hope you guys like it. Peace out. I think this is it for me on the radio, but thanks so much for listening. And once again, www.clearbrookentertainment.com and on Facebook at ClearbrookEnt. So follow us. And yeah, thanks for listening and thanks for your time. And thank you, Iqbal, for having me on the radio.
No worries. Thank you for joining us, Richard.
Cool, cool, cool.
Take care.
Thanks. Yeah.
That was Iqbal Ahmed interviewing. That was Iqbal Ahmed interviewing Richard Weald, a UBC student pursuing his Hollywood dreams.
And now we have a report from Ariel Fournier from downtown Vancouver. Dick Cheney is in Vancouver tonight to promote his book, My Time, a personal and political memoir. Protesters are gathering outside to protest his story, his entry into Canada, and the controversial decisions he unapologetically outlines in his book. As reviewer Maureen Dowd describes his book, he acts like he is America, but America didn't like Dick Cheney. It seems as though Canada doesn't either, but with some critics attacking Cheney on political, moral, and literary grounds, MP Don Davis is arguing he should be denied entry on legal grounds. In a letter to Immigration Minister Jason Kenney, Davis outlines why he thinks Cheney should be barred entry into the country. Our new correspondent, Ariel Fournier, talks to MP Don Davies on his stance.
On what legal grounds do you think that Dick Cheney should be denied entry into Canada?
Well, on very clear and numerous legal grounds. Sections 35 and 36 of the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act spell out a number of different scenarios in which a person is inadmissible to Canada. And I think Mr. Cheney engages all of them, actually.
What specifically are the war crimes that you're specifically going after him for?
Well, generically, I would describe them as if you're convicted of or accused of having committed a crime, a serious crime, a war crime, or a crime against humanity. All four of those are generally mentioned in the Act. And I think that torture, which Mr. Cheney has admitted being part of, satisfies the definition of all four of those.
Mm-hmm. What did you write to Jason Kenney when you wrote him a letter?
Well, on last Friday, when I found out that Mr. Cheney intended to come to Canada today, as a matter of fact, I wrote Mr. Kenney making sure that he was aware of that fact and asking him to uphold the law. I went through the various provisions of the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, and I also quoted a number of international treaties and conventions that Canada has signed, including the Convention Against Torture and the Crimes Against Humanity and War Crimes Act, and a number of Geneva conventions, all of which Canada has signed and all of which require Canada to take measures to make sure that Canada is not a safe haven for those people who have committed acts like torture. Now, Mr. Cheney is here to publicize his book, and in that book, he openly admits he authorized and approved of a program of torture that was applied against people, including against a Canadian citizen. And I think in the face of that, what I told Mr. Kenney was, you have a person who has self-admitted to being part of a torture program, and I asked him to enforce the Immigration Refugee Protection Act accordingly.
And do you think, then, specifically the promotion of this book is part of the issue, then? If another political representative of the states, because Guantanamo Bay is unfortunately so open, they're still at war, do you think that that is a particular issue, or do you think that other American government representatives should be barred entry?
Well, I've been very clear, and I want to be very clear to make it plain that this is not about Mr. Cheney's politics or ideology. It's about the law. For instance, one of the sections of IRPA that I mentioned renders someone inadmissible if they were a senior official in the service of a government that, in the minister's opinion, has engaged in, and it lists a number of things, war crimes or crimes against humanity. So this is not about us disagreeing with Mr. Cheney's politics. It's about enforcing in an even and consistent manner Canadian law. So there could be other members of the American government that hold the same views as Mr. Cheney that would have no problem entering Canada, provided that they weren't senior officials and were involved in a program that I think all right-minded people would agree constitutes torture. You know, I think it's important to think about what exactly we're talking about here. The acts that Mr. Cheney authorized were waterboarding and sleep deprivation, among other things. Waterboarding involves strapping someone to a table, tipping them upside down, and pouring liquid down their throat until they think they're going to die from drowning. Now, I think, and I've challenged the minister to debate me on this, if anybody thinks that that's not torture, then I respectfully disagree with them. And Canada is signatory to many conventions that say that we have zero tolerance for torture. In fact, this summer, the Conservative government made a big deal out of trying to engage the public in tip lines to deport from Canada people that they said were accused of war crimes or had committed war crimes. So, you know, I just believe that law is there for everybody, and if we're going to apply it to one person, we should apply it to everybody, whether we agree with their politics or not.
So then, Dick Cheney then is scheduled to speak in Vancouver tonight.
I consider Jason Kenney and the Conservative government to have failed Canadians in their obligation to uphold Canadian law, and I think they're guilty of hypocrisy as well. You know, another example is, you might remember about a year and a half ago, Jason Kenney refused entry to George Galloway, a British MP, who was coming to Canada. And I think that was an act of ideology, because Mr. Kenney didn't want Mr. Galloway to come in because he disagreed with him. But he did it. And so, you know, I would be very disappointed if our government did nothing and allows Mr. Cheney, who once again has admitted that he has engaged in a program of torture, to come into our country without any consequence.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much, Ariel.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Take care.
Bye.
That was Don Davies on Dick Cheney's entry into Canada. Ariel Fournier did this interview as part of a new series she'll be doing on human rights issues in Vancouver. And now for a PSA.
Magazine and CITR 101.9 FM are proud to present Drawn Ship's Low Domestic CD Release Party, Saturday, September 24th at Art Bank. Drawn Ship are hot off a tour and one of them is 7 months pregnant, so needless to say, it should be a magical night. Corbin Murdoch will warm up the stage. Admission is $10. $15 gets you into the show, plus sends you home with your own copy of Drawn Ship's fabulous new CD. That's Drawn Ship, Saturday, September 24th at Art Bank. 1897 Powell Street. Welcome back to CITR News 101. And now for some international news coverage.
Thank you. Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah, considered a reformer by the standards of his own ultra-conservative kingdom, declared on Sunday that women will for the first time have the right to vote and run in local and municipal elections in 2015. The announcement by King Abdullah came in an annual speech before his advisory assembly, or Shura Council. It was made after he consulted with the nation's top religious clerics, whose advice carries great weight in the kingdom. For the nation's women, it is a giant leap forward, even though they remain unable to serve as cabinet ministers, or even drive or travel abroad without permission from a male guardian. Saudi women bear the brunt of their nation's deeply conservative values, often finding themselves the target of the unwanted attention of the kingdom's intrusive religious police, who enforce a rigid interpretation of Islamic Sharia law on the streets and public places like shopping malls and university campuses. In addition, Sunday's decision to give women the right to vote and run in municipal elections may not be enough to satisfy the growing ambition of the kingdom's women who, after years of lavish state spending on education and vocational training, who have significantly improved their standing, but could not secure the same place in society as that of their male counterparts. The fact that women must wait 4 more years to exercise their newly acquired right to vote adds insult to injury, since Sunday's announcement was already a long time coming. And the next local elections are in fact scheduled for this Thursday. Some Saudi feminist activists believe that the reason behind this 4-year wait is that the king doesn't want to shake the country and wants to avoid antagonizing the powerful clergy and the conservative segment of the population. In other news from the Indian subcontinent, at least 369 people have died and 700,000 are living in refugee camps because of flooding in southern Pakistan, the country's National Disaster Authority said this Thursday. The flooding in Sindh province has destroyed 1.5 million homes and 41,000 villages, the government said. About 8.2 million have been affected. Along with the deaths, more than 740 people have been injured. About 67% of food stocks have been destroyed, and nearly 37% of the livestock has been lost. Elizabeth Byers, spokeswoman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, said earlier this week, at least 5 million surviving animals are at risk. They lack food and shelter and face increased exposure to diseases and worm infestations. The UN World Food Programme has been distributing food to thousands of people. More than 6,000 schools have been damaged by the floods, and 1,300 education facilities are currently being used as relief distribution sites, officials said. There also was flooding in Balochistan province, but figures about the calamity weren't available. The UN said that it is seeking donors to build a $357 million fund to help the Pakistani government's flood response efforts. It is meant to provide food, water, sanitation, healthcare, and shelter for flood victims for up to 6 months. Pakistan was also the site of massive and deadly flooding in August 2010. It lasted for weeks and caused $9.7 billion in damages to homes, roads, and farmers in southwestern Pakistan. More than 1,700 people died in the 2010 flooding, and more than 20 million were displaced, officials reported. And now we'll have a long discussion on the East African drought crisis that I personally have been following for several months now. So the first question we might want to ask is, how bad is it there? Well, the UN says that East Africa is experiencing the worst drought in 60 years, with more than 10 million people threatened by starvation in four countries: Somalia, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Djibouti. It has been caused by the lack of rains and the failure of governments to adequately finance agriculture and irrigation schemes. Somalia is the hardest hit, with the UN declaring a famine in its Bakool and Lower Shabelle regions. At least 6 out of 10,000 children are dying every day in Somalia, according to the UN. Now we might ask, why is Somalia the worst affected? Since its last national government collapsed in 1991, Somalia has become the classic failed state. The militant group Al-Shabaab, which has links to Al-Qaeda, controls many southern and central areas in Somalia, including those where famine has been declared. The UN-backed government is only in charge of parts of the capital, Mogadishu. After two decades of non-stop fighting, most of Somalia's people were already living close to the edge. And to make matters worse, Al-Shabaab forced most Western agencies out of the areas that they controlled in 2009, severely hampering the aid efforts in much of Somalia. Speaking of aid, we should ask, is enough aid getting through to the victims? The short answer is no. Even though the World Bank has recently announced that it is increasing funding for the drought in the Horn of Africa to nearly $2 billion, there is still a $1 billion shortfall to provide for the estimated 13 million people who are in need in Ethiopia, Kenya, Eritrea, and Somalia. But despite this pledge, it is still very difficult to get aid to Somalia. Even before Al-Shabaab banned aid groups, some food deliveries were looted by gunmen and others were held for ransom by pirates. Some aid agencies have been putting out appeals warning of a crisis for several months, but the effort has only really been ramped up recently, when TV pictures of starving children motivated more people and governments to put their hands in their pockets. The economic crisis may have left many donors and individuals feeling less generous than they would normally be, and others may question whether their aid will actually reach those in need. Well, another question we might need to ask concerning Al-Shabaab are negotiation tactics. Is the UN trying to hold talks with Al-Shabaab? The problem is that Al-Shabaab denies that there is a famine in Somalia. It also fears that Western aid workers are linked to intelligence services, so their suspicions will have to be addressed by the UN. For its part, the UN wants guarantees that its staff will be safe in areas controlled by Al-Shabaab, and in the absence of an agreement, Somalis will flee to Kenya and Ethiopia. Those countries are already struggling to cope with their own food crisis and are nervous about the influx of Somalian refugees. They fear that the refugees could threaten their stability with Al-Shabaab fighters entering under the guise of refugees. Now, given this bleak scenario, one should ask, how could the situation improve? Most of the affected people in Somalia, Kenya, and Ethiopia are pastoralists and nomads. Livestock is key to their livelihood, but many of their animals, including drought-resistant camels, have died. This means that they will take many years of good rains to recover. And in Somalia's famine-hit areas, rains are only due in November. The people who have fled the famine are unlikely to return anytime soon to plant their crops. The Famine Early Warning Systems Network predicts that the whole of southern Somalia will experience a famine in the next month or two. Famine hit Lower Shabelle was once Somalia's breadbasket, but the conflict has forced many farmers and businessmen to leave the country. And ultimately, can peace be restored to Somalia? This is the long-term way to solve the hunger crisis, but it is not easy. The lack of ways to earn a living and the absence of any government to enforce laws also explains why so many young Somali men have taken to become pirates in the Indian Ocean. The country is torn apart not only by religious conflict, but also by clan divisions. Since Somalia descended into anarchy, there have been lots of peace talks, but barely any peace. More than a dozen initiatives spearheaded by the African Union, the UN, and regional countries have collapsed. Military interventions by foreign countries have also failed. About a decade later, Ethiopia... Now there are African Union peacekeepers in Somalia, but only 9,000 troops of a promised 20,000 have been deployed, and they are confined to a small part of Mogadishu. Al-Shabaab controls the rest of the capital and most southern and central areas.
Thank you for that, CJ. Next, we go to an interview with News 101 director Iqbal Ahmed. He interviewed Carmen Chung of the BCCL, in which they discuss the deportation proceedings of former Clareton University professor Hassan Diab.
Okay, so first of all, can you just please provide our listeners with some background on Mr. Hassan Diab and what exactly the French government is charging him with?
What this case involves is the extradition of Professor Hassan Diab. Mr. Diab is a Canadian citizen, and he is his extradition is being sought by the French government on charges arising from his alleged involvement with a bombing in Paris in October of 1980. Mr. Diab has no criminal record in Canada, and he has taught at Carleton University at the University of Ottawa, and at the time of his arrest at the request of the French government in November 2008, he was a lecturer at Carleton University.
Mm. And so why is this case coming up now if this bombing happened so many years ago?
Well, according to the French authorities, they received new information implicating Professor Diab in this bombing that took place, like over 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. But the nature of that information is undisclosed, and then it's one of the key problems in this case, because much of the key information and evidence against Professor Diab comes in the form of unsourced intelligence information.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that one of the big issues that BCCLA is taking with the extradition is the evidence or the nature of the evidence. And so what is exactly wrong with it? Why is this unsourced information controversial?
Well, there are a couple of issues that we have with the use of unsourced intelligence information in courtrooms. As a threshold matter, not knowing the source of any evidence makes it almost impossible to test its reliability. There's no way to know if the intelligence is derived from a human source or a technical source. There's no way to cross-examine or to test that information simply because you have no idea where it came from. It's just information that's out there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first issue. The second issue, though, is specific to France. And it's because France in recent years has been criticized by organizations such as Human Rights Watch for its willingness to use information that's been derived from torture in terrorism investigations and in terrorism trials. And given its documented willingness to use information derived from torture and the fact that this evidence has been shown to have been used in terrorism trials, we're concerned that, because we don't know where this evidence came from, it could be the product of torture.
Mm-hmm. So France is seeking his extradition based on evidence that the BCCLA feels is inadequate, essentially.
Well, we feel like there's two issues. We feel that the extradition is being sought based on evidence where we don't know the provenance of evidence, and so there mm-hmm. are those concerns. And we're concerned that if he's extradited to face trial in France, he would be prosecuted based on unprovenanced and unsourced intelligence.
Okay, and the Department of Justice announced that the unsourced evidence, this is my understanding at least, that the DOJ announced that the unsourced evidence will no longer be used to support the extradition request?
Well, so what happened was the extradition request, so the just to back up a little bit, an extradition proceeding happens in two parts. The first part is a hearing before an extradition judge. And the extradition judge doesn't have to consider whether or not the person being sought is actually guilty of the charges alleged against him. All he has to do is to see if there is a comparable offense that can be charged under Canadian law. Mm-hmm. And in that, and if such a comparable offense exists, whether there is sufficient information to warrant, you know, the potential conviction. That is, if it's possible to convict somebody in a foreign court based on the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a trial. And so after that happens, the decision then goes to the Minister of Justice to decide whether or not to ultimately extradite and surrender the person sought. Mm-hmm. So at the extradition hearing, the Department of Justice, which represents the interests of France in these hearings, decided to withdraw withdraw the unsourced intelligence from its case. And so what that means is that as far as extradition proceedings go, the unsourced intelligence didn't play a role, which is something that we were very happy to see, because last October we wrote a letter to the Minister of Justice expressing our concern that this kind of intelligence information was going to be used in the Canadian court.
Mm-hmm.
But even though it was withdrawn from the extradition hearing, that doesn't mean that France is not free to use it at his trial. Mm-hmm. And so the possibility remains that we might be surrendering a Canadian citizen to face trial based on evidence that that may be derived from torture.
So even though this evidence was said it could not be used in the court, they still decided to extradite him.
Well, so what the decision has been made, the decision so far has been that the extradition court has decided that it's appropriate to order his committal for extradition. So what that means is that the extradition court has now placed the decision in the hands of the Minister of Justice to determine whether or not he will be surrendered to the French authorities. So it's an executive decision now.
Okay. And so part of the letter that the BCCCLA wrote, it said that they're seeking that the Canadian government seek out what they call meaningful legal assurance this evidence will not be used in his trial in France. And in your opinion, kind of like, what are the chances of these? Is there much momentum for this?
Well, there are two things that the BCCLA is asking for in this letter. The first thing we're asking for is that based on what we've seen, the safest course is to not surrender Professor Diab at all.
Mm-hmm.
That is, that we decline to surrender him because we don't know whether or not this kind of evidence will be used against him
mm-hmm.
in a French court. So that's the first thing that we ask for. In the alternative, if the Minister of Justice does decide to surrender Professor Diab,
mm-hmm.
then we have asked that the government at the very least, seek meaningful legal assurances that the unsourced intelligence will play no role in his prosecution.
Mm-hmm. So maybe aside from the fact whether he is innocent or guilty of the charges, if the Canadian government they accept your first request and not extradite him at all, would he be tried in Canada for the bombing?
Well, if the Canadian government and the Department of Justice here has sufficient information to prosecute him, then they're free to do that.
Okay. Okay, is there anything else you'd like to add about this case?
Well, our view of this case is really one of fundamental justice. What does it mean for Canada to extradite one of its citizens to face trial in a foreign jurisdiction?
Mm-hmm.
So we believe that in order for Canada to do this, it has to make sure that the proceedings in that foreign jurisdiction are fair. And as part of Canada's commitment to the eradication of the use of torture, it has to make sure that none of its activities can be considered or construed as supporting torture, which means that none of the conduct that Canada undertakes can be or should be construed as being complicit in torture. And so we have to make sure that whatever we do regardless of the relative guilt or innocence of the individual at stake, we maintain a fidelity to our commitment against the use of torture or evidence derived from torture or anything related to allowing torture to exist.
Mm-hmm. And is there any evidence that this extradition process might be almost politically motivated in French-Canadian relations rather than around the legality of what's going on?
Well,